your face. Con in the streets. Jesus in the sheets. That's how our con went. It was beautiful.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to talk about DragonCon 2017 here in Atlanta, Georgia. For anyone who doesn't know, DragonCon is one of the, I think it's the largest fan-organized convention.
I've definitely heard that parlayed around.
Yeah, and I think this past year they crested 82,000 members. Lots of people. I think crowd control was a lot better, but we just wanted to talk about the things we did. There's, you know, it does no good for us to kind of tell anyone what DragonCon is because everyone has very different experiences. If you want to find out more about the con, you can go to their website, DragonCon, I think it's .org.
Mm-hmm.
Look into that. See if you want to go. Please don't just go for one day. Go for all four.
Yes, go on Saturday.
No,
yes,
please don't.
And just hang around in the street and block the way. I have to think about the guy's experience, like the one we saw, I think possibly in the Marriott near that cafe area. I'm not sure if it was a Marriott or Hyatt. And he was sitting in that little pink box. Remember that?
Yeah.
And he was just... Now, that guy's experience, I want to know how he experienced DragonCon. Because in my mind, he just sat there in that little pink box and just watched people pass by.
Just watched people.
Yes.
Trying to hand them pamphlets of maps to Atlanta
yes.
and information.
It's so great.
Yeah.
Loved it.
No, it's really fun. So you'll hear us grouse and complain about certain aspects, but any large gathering of people is going to have problems.
Yeah, even potlucks, you know, are shit shows. So, I mean,
depending on the family and the
yes,
people that are bringing
exactly.
food.
Exactly. Yeah. I'd rather go to Dragon Con than most potlucks.
So I guess what we're going to do is kind of break this up. This might be one of two. This might be one of three, however long they take.
One of 77.
Well, the con itself is technically only Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday during Labor Day weekend. We checked into our hotel on Wednesday, though, because Thursday is where everyone's scrambling to get their badges. And there are some con events now on Thursday.
Yeah, like a little teaser, like a taster.
Right.
Sprinkling of different events.
Taste test. So you don't necessarily need a badge to get in everywhere. During the actual Friday through Monday section, though, you either have to have a room key or a hotel key.
No.
A hotel key, like room
you
card,
need to have somebody's hotel
or a
key
badge. Like you can't just walk into the hotel bar and people watch anymore like you used to be able to. So keep that in mind if you want to just people watch. There are restaurants where people do that.
Can you imagine that though? Can you imagine people just coming in
to
the
happen.
Marriott? Yeah, that's the used to happen is fine.
Yeah.
But now people doing that. The congestion would be mind-numbing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are people that lock up that Hooters that's across from the Westin, and they will just people watch all night because it's got that outdoor bar smoking patio thing where you can order from there. And so they'll just line up shots or drinks or whatever and catcall people, which is irritating, or, like, make fun of fat people walking around in costume, which is also irritating. But mainly they're there to people watch, like, even though they're kind of assholes about it occasionally.
I imagine you probably have the asshole contingent in the Hooters crowd. There are probably some chill dudes there just checking out cosplay boobs, basically.
So, I guess we can start off on Thursday, since that's when we started doing events and such.
Yeah, I definitely think of it as like a taster. I was looking through it. And a lot of the tracks have like a little thing here and there you can kind of try out. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, like the thing we did, the first panel, I guess, we went to was the Almost Classic AMVs. That was part of the Silk Road. Silk Road track is all the Japanese programming and the anime and stuff like that.
It definitely felt classic to me. Like, you don't have to make it almost. Those were definitely classics.
Oh, well, so...
I mean, what would the classic AMVs be? Well, like the ones made on VHS in like 82?
No, well, so I'm an old enough anime fan that I was completely unaware of any of these anime that he was listening. They were all very well edited. And that guy was like a true historian. Like, I learned about some things, and learned about some techniques.
It was great.
I didn't know that there were different types of AMVs.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, the method of their creation, where it's just like, yeah, we're going to sketch this type of anime, and it takes forever to do, and there are these two sisters, and they're huge in that scene specifically for this one type of anime.
Yeah, we need to have, like, he needs to have his own little, like, branch in the Smithsonian, like, for him and his AMVs.
Yeah.
And come on, Smithsonian, get on that.
Smithsonian?
Yeah, get with the kids. The kids want the cool stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, no, like, I felt one of the things that kind of permeated throughout Con for me, and maybe it's just you commented on maybe I look like an asshole, even though I don't think I am.
I think that's been translated that it was deftly worded, and it was about 2 to 3 paragraphs after it translated in Zach's head the basic intent of the message, and then it's been boiled down to that for storage. Like, that's what I was getting at, but it was with a very nuanced argument.
Yeah. Like, when we were trying to find the panel, because, you know, the con is spread out amongst, what, 5 host hotels now? And a bunch of little ancillary hotels where people actually have rooms, like we did.
Just as a final detail of the asshole comment.
Oh, okay.
Zach lovingly was wearing his, I was explained, his prescription sunglasses, but that made his combo outfit just like a creeper dude. Like,
of a t-shirt and cargo shorts?
Yes, with your sunglasses on in a scene that is getting used to, like, being invaded, people being belligerent, people just being downright crude, and you are none of those.
No, not at all.
You're not any of those, but you instantly get profiled. Like,
yeah, I guess that's true.
The only thing that would complete it, that would really complete it for you, is if you did wear a trench coat over yourself and you had your glasses and your beard. And you were like, hey, how you doing? Like, in your genuinely nice, friendly way. It would be like, that dude wants to, like, drag me in an alley and then just, like, show me his goods and rub them in my face and then run away. And that's not Zach at all. But, you know, I was just saying, like, he had a visual package that wasn't helping him out.
Yeah. Well, like...
Continue.
I found that there was just a general attitude of rudeness, I think, this time. From the congoers, not the... The staff. I mean, the staff were all pleasant as far as I could tell.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, trying to find where these rooms are, the Hilton has just finished their basement. Like, they've just remodeled. It used to be the gaming room, and now there's a bunch of different rooms. And so we go down, and I have the map of the Hilton up on my phone, and I think it's this one room, especially since I see a huge line of people crowded around. And I walk up to this lady, and I know people are very particular about being touched, so I didn't want to, like, tap anyone on the shoulder or anything, but I just kind of, like, waved near my face and said, hey, excuse me, could you tell me if this is blah, blah room? And she looks at me, and she goes, if you don't know what this is, then you're not one of us. And I go, oh, okay. And one of our friends pointed out that there were people standing in line that were wearing... tails that were creeping out of their pants, and leather. And it's like, you know what? I'm fine if you're down with alternative scenes and things like that. Just tell me. If you're not adult enough to tell me what you're there to do, or say, no, you're probably looking for this room, you don't even have to tell me what you're doing there.
Mm-hmm.
But just no, that's not what this is.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't have even have been... good if she just been like, no, yeah, this is blah, blah, blah. Or, hey, is this such and such room? And because I think you asked her, like, what event is there? And then you might have said, is this, that? And then she kind of just interjected and she's like, no, you know, like how you described.
Yeah.
And I knew as soon as she said what she said and the way she said it, I was like, Zach's going to be really pissed about that. And as soon as she said it, I was like, oh, no.
Well, I mean, I was just like, oh, okay. And I just walked away from her. I was just like, wow, that's really rude. This first night in, you normally people get like that on Monday.
Yeah, Zach quietly pissed. Not like him, like, throwing a temper tantrum or something.
No, I didn't get in her face and yell.
No, Zach.
Just like, oh, okay, and backed off.
Zach, civilized angry, is just like typing up like a bad review on Yelp, be like, I can't believe your decorations were completely in direct conflict with the mood of the meal.
Yeah. Well,
that's being civilized. It's being civilized. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
So we eventually tracked down the Almost Classic AMV panel.
Mm-hmm.
I learned some things from it. It was entertaining.
It was. And I think just like the Godzilla Kaiju panel last year.
Yeah.
When you have someone that is just a genuine fan.
Yeah.
And who is like really knowledgeable, regardless of their own, almost regardless of their own particular personality and style, as long as they are sharing it with you and they're bringing in details, that it really takes someone who like gets deep into the minutiae of that particular fandom can only draw out, then it's a good panel. It's a good sit down.
Yeah. No, he was entertaining, and he was showing people things that it seemed like, even though the crowd there was younger than either of us, like these were probably high school, early college students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was even showing them things that they had never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that seemed to wow them, or at least make them laugh the most,
mm-hmm.
because it's probably bad and ridiculous, are animes that I remember, or AMVs that went around when I was in anime club in high school or college. Mm-hmm. which it's just funny how the scene changes.
Oh yeah. They're like, oh yeah, ha ha.
That's old.
Inuyasha. Oh, no. It's for the plebs.
Yeah, but it's funny how some things never change. Like, I don't know if you've ever been to Anime Weekend Atlanta.
Mm-mm.
It's specifically anime, obviously. There are always, I think there are always going to be the guys that walk around with cat ears on top of a hat with their hair pulled back and the ponytail dyed a separate color than the rest of their head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just a look that seems to be in the scene and will never get old.
Mm-hmm. Is that from something in particular?
I have no idea, other than maybe like Tokyo street fashion.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
I mean, Tokyo street fashion changes like every mm-hmm. season is my understanding, but this is just something specific to American anime culture.
There probably won't be not that it's a majority of things, but there probably is, you know, someone doing Naruto cosplay at Anime Week in Atlanta somewhere.
Yeah.
That's a thing. Never die, never die, Naruto.
I like anime, not Naruto.
Shut up. You like Naruto just because you mentioned it. At some point in time, you loved it.
Okay. That must be how that works.
That's exactly how that works.
Anything else to say about the AMV panel other than that it was fantastic, and I wish that I got that panelist's name. Unfortunately, because it was on Thursday, it didn't seem like his name was listed as a panelist.
Oh, that's interesting. I'll have to look it back up. I mean, I'm sure he talked about being part of that the production of that one video we saw. You know, the one that would...
where they would, the different editors had like 10 seconds mm-hmm. of this one song. Yeah.
So he's listed as one of the contributors for that, so you could probably find him with that.
Yeah, I could probably track him down. It'd be cool if we could get him for an interview.
Detective maybe. Work.
Like a Skype interview.
It'd be cool. We'd just break into his apartment and just like just be sitting there with some rope. We're going to interview you now.
Talk into this microphone, please.
Just like rub it on his face. Yeah, I did show my niece some of the video footage and stuff, and she was like, "Oh, that's like from Two Apples or something like that." So,
she's
into AMVs. So,
okay.
She's a huge anime fan, and
okay,
she's got all the buzzwords like no dubs and original Japanese only. And I was like, yeah. And some things it matters and some things it doesn't. Like, no one gives a shit if you dub Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. Like, no, I mean, honestly, I like the American voice acting better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Sometimes I listen to some of that original Japanese stuff and it's like, wow. I think it's part of it stylistic to the time.
Yeah.
And, like, there are different cultural indicators. Like, if you're listening to a character, like, oh, that's the hero kind of voice. oh, that's the villain kind of voice.
Yeah.
You know, oh, that's a really gruff masculine character.
Sure.
You know, he's kind of like, he's using like a military kind of voice there, or something like that. So there's a little bit of that in there, but yeah. Let's go with the American voices.
Yeah. And so then after that, we went to the 8-bit ball, right?
Was that on Thursday?
Yeah, that was on Thursday. That was one of the first like dance parties. Most of the nights, by the way, have dance parties. This is going to be kind of slipshod because I've been several years, and so like there are things that happen regularly that you can kind of pick up a feel for and flow once you've been going.
What was the dancing like at the 8-bit ball? I'm trying to remember.
It was like EDM and like video game remixes.
Oh yeah, I remember it had that. It was the one with that big Space Invaders screen.
Yeah,
right?
They had Space Invaders up playing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell if maybe someone up on the stage was controlling a game of some sort, mm-hmm. but they had three different people up on stage. I think two of them were DJs and one of them was like a VJ.
Yeah.
But that was fun. That was one of the dances where a conga line formed inexplicably, or I guess a snake line.
The snake line was amazing. That was great. I didn't, which they might have gone further on, because I think that goes on for a little bit, doesn't it? Like it was several hours event.
Oh yeah, 8-bit ball started, I think, at 9 or 10, because we showed up after it had been going for about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it stops at like 2.
Yeah.
Or so.
Even without like a live feed for them setting up the video game loops, I would have liked to have seen just like other games interject. The only way I could see them playing a live game is if someone was running like an emulator.
Yeah,
they
that's
like
what it
some
had
iteration
to be.
Of, you know, because the game's been re-released a couple times, so you could like you could play it on Xbox 360 or something, because there's all those like Amiga game
collections,
Atari Lynx game collection packages. And if it was just a video, then just cut some other stuff in the video.
Yeah.
Like, that would be kind of cool. I mean, you could have, like, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and then just, like, something cool like that. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Because then the whole, like, everyone would be singing.
Well, based on the description, what I thought was going to happen is that, because, you know, Southern Fried Game Expo and some of the other, like, Tokyo Attack, like, they all bring arcade cabinets for the game room.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that there were going to be like gaming cabs, like in the corners of the dance hall, which I mean, at some point that's dangerous given the fire capacity or fire code capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And you risk your machine and stuff like that. So
people having sex in your machine,
not having it, but like, I was kind of expecting like there to be like a bank of arcades
mm-hmm.
in the corner. So that was,
now, you must have been really disappointed when you showed up then.
No, I wasn't disappointed at all. I had a great time. 8-bit ball was super fun. I think it's one of the few dance parties that I go to.
Do, 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 do.
Boop.
Speak a little more.
Bop, bop, bop.
Mm-mm.
Bop, 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 bop.
You're not getting anything. Well, maybe you are. Talk a little more.
La 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 la.
All right.
Wow.
Good.
Okay.
You can still equalize that. I'm just going to make a note of that.
Okay. Yeah, you may want to note the time signature.
19. Pre-19. So I can actually just equalize that up.
Oh, okay. Even though it's a separate channel?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Do we need to stop and fix it?
No. I'm just going to do that post. I just noticed you seemed a little low, but it might actually just be due to the viewpoint as far as like perspective. But it seems like I'm coming in, and you talk a little bit.
Okay. And then I guess because we're old people, we went back to the hotel room around 1 or so, I would say. Was that about right?
Yeah.
And then we, you know, kind of, we're not 21 or 22 anymore. We're not going to be up pounding drinks till 6 in the morning.
Yeah, I would just go into the restroom and pound them and just cry and vomit.
Yeah,
for no reason.
Like, we all went back to the hotel, put on something stupid to watch because you lovingly brought your PS4
for great. Us
to, mm-hmm. to stream DragonCon TV into the room.
Thank you, unnamed hotel, for having easily accessible Wi-Fi.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Unnamed hotel, because I tell you, somehow we'll get back to the IT guy.
Yeah.
He'll block it. And it was great. We just watched like Netflix and stuff. It was awesome.
Yeah. We turned on Wizards of the Lost Kingdom, which I secretly love now.
It's a classic movie. It's definitely a classic.
So good. So bad. It's the culmination of probably two different movies that ran out of budget that I think Roger Corman just said, well, jam these shits together and we'll make a feature-length movie and we'll make our money back. Done. Like, there are scenes in the prologue that have nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And they're never returned to mm-hmm. again.
It's definitely not seamless. And I think I missed a little bit of the prologue.
Okay.
Which would have kind of cemented that for me. But in the rest of it, you'd have moments where things just didn't really make sense as they were transitioning from one section to another. And it was like, is this going to connect? Like, is this another movie? Like, am I watching another film? And then they would, like, camera cut, splice it to where it kind of ran into each other. And it was like, I see what you did there, but that was still really jarring. Like, I'm being taken out of the believability of this being a story, a narrative.
Yeah.
But it was hilarious. Fantastic.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's the story of a kid who is a magician, I guess, and because it was fashionable at the time, he had a big furry thing that just kind of spoke in noises at him.
Yeah.
That it sounds like Chewbacca. Like
if you gene splashed Chewbacca in a mop,
yeah.
You would get this creature, like a really clean white mop.
And
didn't he have weird hands too? Like his hands were just kind of weird.
Yeah, it was just fabric.
Yeah. Design of the, like, these little like window washers attached to his hands. He's really a majestic creature.
And the like the fighter, quote unquote, of the group, if this were a game, just really an alcoholic murderer. Very unlikable.
He was really weird, and I feel like I've seen him before, but in other things of that period.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen his face.
Well, like, there's a fight scene where he's presumably killing these guys because they don't come up and run away or anything. But he'll like, flip them and, like, break their back and just, like, turn around and look at the body and make a face like he's just had an orgasm and kind of shake his head and just, ooh. And
it's going to be in Zach's fan fiction of this movie.
Mm-hmm. It's so disturbing. And, like, there's a random side plot of the group getting attacked and captured because he was supposed to be married to a Cyclops princess.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And instead, he just murders them.
Yeah, he murders particularly the father.
Yeah.
Who was trying to get him married up.
Mm-hmm.
And he cooks him.
He cooks him.
And then yep. he makes a joke to his daughter about
how he just killed her dad.
Yeah, something about meals or I hate to eat and run, something stupid like that.
Oh, man, it's like a fantasy novel I would write, just horrible.
It is, yeah. Just need to drop in Thomas the Tank Engine and Christine, and we're good. That would be a third film to complete yeah. the film circle in your fan fiction. Just that randomly for 15 minutes in the middle of the forest for no reason. But the kid's pink, purple, lilac suit uniform thing was really disturbing for me. Like, cause that is just, it's such a color.
So weird.
That doesn't fit the tone of the film or fit the tone of a hero.
Nope.
Like, no one's going to wear
really,
purple lilac.
I want to cosplay this group next year at DragonCon. It's going to be a very small percentage of the congoers, I think, that actually get the references to these characters.
I think it would be good if we did, like, a combo. So,
like the kid and his sidekick.
I can definitely do the kid. Like, I'd wear the lilac for the good of the team.
You don't want to be the guy with the crab hat?
The guy with the crab hat?
The no. antagonist? No.
No, that's too much work. Like, just building that and trying to, like, cut the shiny felt up together into that shape? No.
Yeah.
But the purple lilac kid, what else is he are you going to think he's from?
Yeah.
Like anyone that knows the reference would be like, yeah, that's that kid.
That's that kid, especially with that guy that's covered in mop fabric.
And we really could just cut up buy some dollar store mop heads and just make you a shirt. We just tape those up and one on your head and that would be it. And you would just make those stupid noises. And the one that he made when he just passes out and dies. Yeah.
That's another one. There we go.
He passed away. Anyways, we could be on that movie forever because it's great.
Yeah.
I think I like the first one better than the second, but I don't think I watched a lot of the second one.
Okay. Well, so then I guess that brings us to Friday. I think I was up first and out first because mine was the earliest on Friday, I think.
I don't remember.
So I went to another Silk Road panel called Tokyo, City of the Future or Doomed Megalopolis.
Well, what time was that?
I think it was 10.
Yeah, I would have been out too.
Okay.
Because I think the Sailor Moon thing was also 10.
Okay. Well, I'll talk briefly about the Tokyo one.
Fascinating.
There's a lot of dangerous things in Tokyo. Especially with global warming, that city is just straight up going to drown in the ocean, which is unfortunate.
Are they going to use technology and float above? They're just going to they're going to skip destruction and go straight to New Tokyo.
but the guy that was running the panel, he's in charge of the Silk Road. He's the Silk Road track director. He was also an editor for a couple of different manga publishing houses. He lived in Tokyo for almost 2 decades.
Living
right?
the dream, man.
And I only know this because another specific thing with anime fans, it seems to be that the actually guy is peppered throughout the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because he used some term and went on to explain, I forget the word because I haven't had Japanese in years, but he used some term to describe an Akira Kurosawa film, right? And he said the word, and then he says, and what that means colloquially is the lonely death of an individual is what that refers to,
mm-hmm.
right? And someone in the crowd goes, actually, that means going nowhere. And then the guy explained, literally that's what that means. but colloquially, this is something you pick up when you live somewhere for almost 2 decades and shut the guy down.
That's fantastic.
To
do it diplomatically is really a skill.
Yeah, I mean, because that wasn't verbatim, the exchange. That was just the generalized exchange because it was not enough of an impression for me to memorize his slam.
But in all truth, there was a slam.
There was a very subtle slam because also when you live in Japan, you're very good, I think, at slamming people very subtly moving on.
to try to get around, decorum and different kind of societal expectations for behavior.
Yeah.
You have to figure out how to say things.
Will
not technically be a faux pas, but you really just insulted that person. You really cut him down.
There were a ton of interesting facts. I think he said somewhere 150,000 people are moved around in Tokyo every 10 minutes when you go by the rail lines.
Mm-hmm.
And the traffic stops and stuff. That's an insane amount of people for a city that is smaller than Atlanta.
Yeah, that's just insane.
Yeah, he was talking about. There's a doujinshi exchange festival, and one of the audience members has been and was like, "Yeah, you think Dragon Con population is bad? It is no joke here." The guy on the panel said, "Yeah, it's." It's like being in one of the smaller con hotels here, like the Hyatt or the Hilton, but with 3 or 4 times the amount of people there.
Wow.
Because it's only a day. And he was talking about little cultural things that develop because, doujinshi authors, they're, the culture of doujinshi in Japan is actually encouraged, because even if you're broaching IP specific, like technically, it gives the manga houses a way to pick up artists that, so they can crank out more issues of things. And mm-hmm. if they can take a look at someone and bring them on,
real talent, yeah.
that's fine. There are so many people here that sell, and credit card transactions are not like cell phone transactions, like Apple Pay and such. And credit card transactions are just really untenable. And so it's a lot of cash. And so one of the things that's developed is a culture of, it's like you'll see these tiny doujinshi authors, and they'll be leaving the convention with a suitcase of what is almost certainly filled with money. And then they'll have two Yakuza behind them to keep people from knocking them over. Because for 5 or 6 years, that's what would happen, is like local street toughs would run up, grab a suitcase, threaten someone, make off with all their money. And so the Yakuza stepped in and go, give us a percentage and we'll make sure this doesn't happen. Well, yeah, and the relation with Yakuza in Japan are is really interesting too, because like he was saying that his wife was actually in one of the earthquakes, I think in Kobe or Kyoto. Mm-hmm. And the culture there, the people kind of tolerate the Yakuza because they make things happen much quicker than the way their government is set up. So like after the earthquakes, the JDF was there, the army was there, waiting on orders from the government on how to help. Well, the government was moved. The wheels of government grind slowly, especially in a place like Japan that's very bureaucratic, right? And so they're waiting on orders for how to help or what they can do. The religious organizations have all boarded up and everyone has gone. Well, the Yakuza own a lot of the shipping things, so they have big trucks. They own a lot of the bars and food, so they have access to food and water. So Yakuza show up the day after the earthquake, and they're handing out hot meals and water. Whereas it could take a week for the military to step in and do anything. Yeah. So it's just an interesting cultural difference.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty much all I can say about that. It's an interesting panel.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's not one of those things that you see everyone getting to do for a period of time and bringing it back. So even if you visited, like if you've gone there before and you visited some of the major cities and you took the rail line, it's a different experience from someone who's lived there for a period of time and kind of breathed air and witnessed like different cultural things happening. And so it's still just like, it's almost like an explorer from a foreign land still coming in and recounting their tales.
Well, it's funny. The Japan has been destroyed so many times. Like mm-hmm. even in their fiction, he was making the point that, you know, Tokyo is just leveled in a lot of their fiction. Like look at Akira, look at every Godzilla movie. Like it's constantly a city that's being rebirthed, even in fiction, because a lot of their cities have been razed. World War II, the Fukushima incident, tsunamis, earthquakes. Like they're very good at rebuilding, right? Which is interesting panel.
So much talent there, you know.
Even
just the doujinshi. Not like I would know, but the artists are sometimes fantastic.
Yeah,
the level of artistry is like that is amazing, and I think it really has to do with my fascination with the line. Like line, because with a lot of manga, you know, you're dealing with like a black and white medium, and it's the power of the line and the different kind of pens that they use, and sometimes with some of the more like traditional tools, with like a softer nib pen, it's just like it's fantastic.
Yeah,
like I can't even scrawl my name legibly, and thinking of the level of artistry in just like a single line is just astounding.
Yeah.
What did we have?
So we'll trade off. What did you do? Because you guys, I met up with you guys briefly to eat, think, in the lobby of the Hilton.
Yeah.
And then you guys went off to do something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we shared in your enthusiasm after the experience for...
Oh, yeah.
With the... what you were just detailing right now.
Yeah.
and the structure of Tokyo. I think you remember mentioning how, like, it's connected in a way that you have these little separate areas.
Oh yeah, he was saying that the term megalopolis is an architectural or a city planning term that was developed specifically for Tokyo, because it's made up of, that one city is made up of three smaller cities that are larger than most other places.
And they're just like right next to each other.
Yeah, they're right next to each other. You're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people just jammed into a small area together. And so there's a lot of shared space that, like, you'll see it happen in pockets in the U.S., like in New York or like mm-hmm. Chicago or D.C. or L.A.
I mean, I'd gather that most, you know, people in New York, well, they may think, you know, you're living in a small space, you know, you're not actually living in like a little box. Like, you open up and
yeah.
some people are just like a space that's, you know, not much bigger than like a desk, you know, and a yeah. little bit over. And I know they have their little, like, some of the areas that are, I know Beijing has that issue as well, like a sleeping quarter where it's just like these little stacked.
Yeah, they're stacked pods that, mm-hmm. yeah.
You can just go in and sleep in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's funny to think about the geography there and the social structure, and that you would kind of have to have a really polite society.
Yeah.
If you were going to be packed in like,
yeah.
like rats on top of, you know, rats. You know,
oh, yeah.
Just like to be that dense a population. I mean, see how New York is just like, yeah, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, fuck off. And that's, you know, how they kind of deal with that kind of pressure and that stress. But I imagine there's also an element of people that are trying to survive within that. And outwardly, they're very composed. But inwardly, like, there's conflict because it's, you know, a human thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's probably some stresses associated with that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there are.
I mean, there are people that, you know... I think I've read a couple different articles that are even just like not even directly related, but they're talking about there was one for people that get slightly agoraphobic in Japan, how they kind of just like get holed up in their apartments and then just kind of just like disappear.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. Well, issue. I mean, we didn't talk about that. Like that yeah. the main thrust of the thing was is Tokyo a great place to live? Yes, it is. Is it also probably going to wash away in the next 30 years? probably. Better go while you can.
That's great.
But I mean, that may not be the case. Who knows?
As soon as the big tidal wave comes, that's when Godzilla is going to rise and push that water out of the way. We're just waiting. You're destined to come. And I think... at the same time that Zach was watching that, I was doing the Sailor Moon voice panel, which was really interesting because there were obviously fans of all different shapes, ages, and sizes and genders. And it was good. The ladies there that were a part of the voice panel, I don't know if I have their names down, but you know, the ones that put Luna... all the different Sailor Scouts, Sailor Moon. I think we had...
You said Sailor Mars was there, right?
There was Sailor Mars. There's Sailor Moon. There was Luna. And then there would have been someone else that I can't remember now.
Ah.
But they were great. They obviously have... become accustomed, and they talked about it quite a bit as right. far as they recorded these sequence of episodes and really were just kind of blown away because it was sort of a novel concept for them to record something that was a sequence of, okay, this is something from Japan, these are these characters, yes, you're going to be voicing a talking cat. You know, and that was like, okay, sure.
Sure, where's my check? Okay, great.
And it was funny, they talked about how they all really wanted to do Sailor Moon. And not just also in light of, okay, being the titular character, you know, of the show, but also because that Sailor Moon, if you've ever seen even just like a 10-second gif of Sailor Moon, she's really friend devoted. She's also very clumsy.
Yeah.
You know, she likes to eat. You know, she just like engorges herself on food.
Yep.
She makes mistakes. She acts really goofy and silly. But she's also like a strong character.
Sure.
And who stays devoted to like her friends and kind of, you know, protecting her little realm in the world. And how it would be really nice, because back then, there, especially with voice acting, even just like being a regular actress, those kind of roles where you could be someone like silly and goofy and human,
right,
weren't really that common. And so that was really appealing. Well, think about like what kind of animated characters would you be voicing for a show that aren't just like one-dimensional in that time period.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Because, yeah, in American animation, I think there was what? Like Animaniacs, Darkwing Duck, like the Disney shows. But that's, mm-hmm. like, you can't really delve into any sort of character development or anything. Yeah.
And especially for, like a female character. You know, Darkwing Duck isn't a chick.
Yeah.
Not in common thing now. And then you had Dot from the Animaniacs. I mean, she didn't really get that many. Dot had some really great moments, though. Let's not knock Dot. Dot was great. And, yeah, so they talked about that. They talked a little bit about their different voice production work and that whole process. And I think it was really great. They had a little story about how, I think, is her name Susan, the one that does the voicing for Sailor Moon?
I have no idea.
I can't remember. I did have her on here. And they talked about how she had come in one day and she had to... there's Luna. I'm looking up... no, Terry. Terry Hawks. 95 to 98. Okay. So how she had come in to record the Sailor Moon portions, and they talked a lot about how physically it was very difficult to record those high pitches of kind of voices of the character. And they said their director who directed the show had never really directed like an animated show, and I think didn't even have that much directing experience per se. And I think I remember them talking about how she was a French woman who had a very particular idea about production and performance.
Huh.
And she didn't even let them get the scripts beforehand because she said she wanted them to read it fresh. Like, she wanted fresh...
That's interesting.
Like, yeah, it's bullshit. It's what it is. Yeah. She wanted them to read it fresh without influence of conception of the story or, like, the narrative, like, where their vocal was placed. She just wanted, like, virgin performances. And so they said they'd record most of their lines and have no idea where the characters were in that point in time or what was going on in the show or anything that was occurring. Like, so they would record a line, record a segment, and have no idea, like, what the plot of the show was. They just knew, like, okay, this is what you're supposed to be feeling. This is what's happening right now. But where it, like, sat in their narrative structure, like, they were just clueless. And so Sailor Moon, Terry Hawks had come in to record it. And she was talking about how she'd come in and done a performance, and she was really just like squeezing all that pressure out. And then that same day, some of the other voice actresses had come in right after her, and they made a funny note on how that recording booth is completely soundproof and airproof and draftproof. And so she had like let one out, like had too many hot dogs earlier that day. And so they were just hot boxed. And so when they went in, they're like, hot dogs. Oh, there's like chili dogs here. Intense. And so they really...
That's funny.
Yeah, they really cut her for that. And I thought that was pretty great. And you could tell they obviously have a level of comfort with each other.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, how could you not if you share a, what, probably 3x3 effectively closet with a mic in your face?
Yeah.
And you're doing that for, what, 4 years? Yeah, yeah. Like you're going to... You're going to have some fart jokes that built up.
And they did talk about, I think, on rare occasions, they get to go in and record like a voice kind of at the same time for like a dramatic scene or something. Oh, like okay. That. You know, I guess if they were like yelling maybe or something like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was great. Mostly, like, it's been a while since I'd seen the show. But I did remember them and their voices, and they did, you know, do a little performance, little segment that you would do at like voice panels, like acting out a voice and particular lines and stuff like that. So
yeah, well, that's not the only voice actor panel you went to.
It isn't. It isn't. I really enjoy the animation, and you know, I can't go up and hug Sailor Moon per se, but I can go meet the person that voiced them.
Yeah,
I mean not. Not without going to a different kind of con. That is possible in the privacy of my home. Just like a big waifu pillow.
Sailor Moon.
Sailor Moon, yeah. And you know what you could do is you could get... You could just have a big body pillow.
Yeah.
And just have tons of different sheet covers for it. So you could have like Sailor Moon week. You could
Starscream week.
Exactly. Exactly. He knows where I'm going. And so that was great. It was a great voice panel. After that, I think I did stories with Uncle George Lowe, the voice of Space Ghost, and he was fantastic.
Yeah, you seemed really jazzed to after that.
I'm jazzed to even just the thought of watching the shows again, which I'd have to get them. I'm sure they're like on Blu-ray somewhere or on.
Are they?
At least on DVD somewhere. They have to be. If not official publication, they have to be somewhere fan-based. Because there has to be a fan that... I mean, because if you had Doctor Who, like, put onto VHS tape by fans of the time, then assuredly someone grabs Space Ghost. And, because you'd have guests on Space Ghost Coast to Coast. I don't know if you ever watched the show.
Yeah.
But you would have guests like Beck.
And
I think Beck came on one time, and I think the initial exchange with Beck was just like sitting there, and like Space Ghost, you know, George Lowe's voice character would just be like, "Hi," and Beck would be like, just kind of bobbing his head.
He's got a devil's haircut in his mind, though.
Yeah, that's what it must have been.
$50.
There we go. Volumes 1 through 3.
Yeah,
and he did have. George Lowe, at least from just that talk, and even afterwards, because I went to go meet him in the Walk of Fame, he has a brain that is like a thought tree. And that basically, he's not really a human, he's just a neural network of memories. So if you touch upon one of those synapses,
it'll go firing off in eight directions?
You get all those different directions. Because he's just, like, going through them. He's just, like, just, like, flying through his memories. So if you ask him a particular pointed question, you're not really going to get the answer to that question. But you will get everything that fires along those synapses. And then if you collect it together, you're going to get the answer to that question.
Right.
So during the panel, you'd ask him one question.
Right.
And you got 15, 16 minutes later, he's still just going on.
So it's like a Kevin Smith Q&A where like three people asked a question?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the funny thing was is that I thought all his answers were really great. And another thing about that, too, is that it seemed to me in conversation, it'd be really hard for him to just have like a stock answer to a question. Because I wouldn't really say I'm a fan of conversation, but I'm a fan of watching how people talk and how they think and move along. And so watching how he'd go about answering a question is really indicative of that person's mind and the way they think. And so he'd build up, like, you'd ask him a question about, okay, what was it like to do production for the show, or how'd you guys get in the concept of the show?
Sure.
And so then for 5 to 10 minutes, he'd be talking about one of his friends that was there during the production. And so you would get like a mini bio of this other person. And then he would give you like that person's character quirks and like different things that they would do. And it's related to the question, but not directly, not in the way that most people talk.
Right.
Because when most people talk, like they're they want to answer your question. So they'll keep it like near and be like, okay, we got to this, we got to that. And that's not the kind of answer you got. You got like a,
sure,
like a spattering of things. And then invariably at the end of all of his answers, he'd be like, I'm not sure if they answer your question. And it was like, well, it did. And it kind of didn't, but you do you. I like the way you did that.
So did you ask him anything?
Yeah, it was funny because I asked him one question initially, and then I sat back down. And then I think two other people asked him a question. And then he asked, like, anybody else have any questions? And no one else raised their hand. And I was like, well, shit, I'm just going to ask him another question.
Yeah, you're never going to be on Coast to Coast now. You may as well.
I'm going to ask him another question. And so I asked him another question. He just, like, went on. And it's one of those... it was one of those answers. It's hard to like remember like the exact way it came out because it doesn't have like a logical coherent form. It's kind of like if you had like a one page paper.
Okay.
That was trying to, okay. That was like the history of the production of Space Ghost.
Okay.
And then you know how each paragraph has a particular like topic and then supporting arguments to that topic. It was like if you had that one-page paper,
okay,
and he was just skipping from sentence to sentence
randomly
in some of the other paragraphs. And they were still connected, though, in the, how he was hitting them. And it was just fascinating because to watch someone with the comedic mind and the kind of comedic timing of someone to do Space Ghost, you'd gather that would kind of have to be how your brain was.
Yeah.
And because he talked about... one really cool segment. I think he was talking to one of the Marsalis brothers.
Okay.
I think it wasn't Winton. I think it might have been Brandon.
Brandon?
He mentioned the Marsalis brothers a couple times, so I can't remember which one it was. But anyways, he was asking him, because he was like an interview, you know, a guest on the show, and I think he was asking him, like, one of the Marsalis brothers, I'm like, oh, so what's like your favorite kind of song and stuff, you know, performance? Because Space Ghost was like, oh, I really like jazz. And Marsalis brother was like, yeah, what kind of song do you like? And so then he gave him like the name of a song, you know, that he'd been listening to, because apparently he's a jazz head.
Okay.
And Marsalis brother was like, you don't know that song. And so George Lowe started scatting the beginning melody of that song. So he's like, and then at the end of it, I was like, oh man, you know that song, Space Ghost. And that was just awesome. It was amazing. Because that's exactly what Space Ghost would do. Because it's, and really George Lowe, but within the context of a conversation, you'd be riffing on something, and there'd be sort of a nonsensical element to it. But it's kind of like, playing catch with a concept. Like he'd throw that to him, and then George Lowe, being a human, having his own kind of properties and stuff, he would contribute.
Yeah,
you know, like that's random, but it's not the way random is in like a meme is.
Yeah.
Now it has a context. There's like a
sure
of a conversation basically to unite it, and so a lot of, you know, a lot of the stuff and kind of form of things I think are funny were really shaped by Space Ghost.
Yeah.
And Brack and Zorak and Moltar.
Moltar.
Fucking Moltar. Oh, I love Moltar.
Man, now I really want to go back and rewatch Space Ghost.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a fun show. Especially like in the middle of the night, because they weren't afraid of... And he did... I think he was talking about how he read like a Times article recently, like in the past year, or like a Slate article, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't think it was Vice. It was like one of those other publications. And it was he was talking about, one second. The article was talking about how Space Ghost was kind of, I wouldn't say it was experimenting. I hate to use the word revolutionary because I think buzzwords like that are used all the time, just like catch people's attention. But it was really experimenting with a different kind of talk show format, in the way that it was basically making fun of talk show conventions within the space of a show. And like you'd have on Space Ghost, this is freaking very often, like you'd have questions asked. And well, what's one of the conventions of a talk show, or late night talk show especially, that you watch it, there's not supposed to be awkward pauses.
Yeah.
You know, if there's an awkward pause and people are just looking at each other, it's really discomforting for the viewer. And Space Ghost would do that all the time. Yeah. And then the only thing you could hear would be like Zorak's eyes blink and it'd be like doom doom. Yeah. Or the camera would cut to Moltar and Moltar would be like, oh, this is not going really well. And it's so great. It's even better now thinking about it as an adult. But as a kid, you know, I was still just really amused by it. Yeah. I watched the Brack show. Like Brack.
Oh, I didn't know he had his own show. I remember as a kid being allowed to stay up on whatever night it aired. My dad found Space Ghost Coast to Coast hilarious. Yes, and so we'd watch like 20, 30 minutes of it. And then I would go to bed because I was a little kid when it was on. I was like 9 or 10.
Did your dad ever watch like Johnny Carson or
any? No. He watched Letterman when he was in, shortly out of college, I guess, because it would have been in the 80s, back when he was doing really zany, weird, not late night type stuff. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I remember watching like Letterman. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I think he likes Conan now, or Conan.
Yeah, and I think
Conan.
He loves Conan.
Late
night talk show.
Oh man, now I want to have Conan.
That'd be great.
And, the late night talk show.
So I imagine for your dad, it would have been like especially hilarious realizing like exactly as an adult what that show was doing with the talk show conventions.
Yeah.
He would just be like, wow, this is just insane.
Yeah.
And you'd have it, too. Like, I can think back on segments on Space Coast Coast where the guests would just, like, get up. Not out of anger, but they would just, like, get up and just, like, walk away. Just, like, go do something.
Yeah.
Grab a drink, come back. And then the other guys would just kind of, like, riff it off. So, yeah, I need to get that box set.
Yeah. You should.
I definitely should. I'm going to get the Blu-ray version for the ultimate in 3/4 fidelity. On my screen. It's going to be so good. It's great. Yeah. No, anyways, I could talk about that show forever.
Yeah.
Especially with that. But George Lowe's a great guy. Great experience. If he's there in any Connor convention, go and support him because he needs
all the help he can get. He's probably typecast at this point. Yeah. Because Space Ghost is just his regular speaking voice, right? Like, with very little adjustment.
Yeah, it's very little modulation. Like, I can close my eyes and get halfway there. There's a little more that he does with his voice, like in funny segments. That's more really just like a part of acting.
Yeah.
But it's mostly his speaking voice. Yeah.
Yeah. So he probably can't. I mean, he's not like H. John Benjamin, where he can use the same voice and have different characters, but the same exact voice.
Yeah.
Space Ghost is kind of iconic.
Yeah. I mean, if I hear just like a car commercial with George Lowe on it, it's like, Space Ghost is selling Yukons. That's so great. You go, Space Ghost. So, yeah, there we go. That was George Lowe. I think probably want to hand it back off to you.
Was the other voice actor...
No, that panel was just you went George to
that
Lowe.
Was on. Oh, okay, that got was it, George got Lowe. It.
The other voice actor,
okay,
I think would have been maybe Saturday.
So yeah, my wife and I met back up after my Tokyo panel, and we kind of people watched some, went back to the room, ate, and then we went out to see a panel called Goth, Heart of Darkness, right? And it's kind of commentary on the goth scene as it is today versus how it kind of started. And the panelists were Steven Archer of Ego Likeness and my new favorite band Stoneburner, Aurelio Voltaire, Rogue from the Crew Shadows, Ted Nafee, who oddly was the only non-musician on the panel. He's a comic book artist.
Oh, really?
Like he does Princess Ugg, Knights Dominion. I forget the name of the, like, there's a reason he was in the goth panel is that he sold like movie or TV rights to like Emily Crumb or something like that. Mm-hmm. It may be Emily Crumb, but a comic like that, band member from The Long Lost. And I believe the two musicians from Bella Morte.
Okay.
They're kind of like a rock or a psychobilly
sizable panel.
It was huge. Like, like so the way they had it set up.
That's a lot of,
is there was
kind of
let's see there was Rogue, the Ted Nafee, two guys from Bella Morte, one guy from Long Lost, Aurelio Voltaire, and Steven Archer. So there's seven people on the panel, and the moderator was actually standing. He kind of had a chair in front of the stage, and whenever he needed to moderate or ask a question because the conversation wasn't really going anywhere or the question had been answered, he would kind of stand up and do his thing with one of the microphones up there, right? Like, it was a jam-packed panel. It was really interesting to hear commentary from current goth musicians about their beginnings. They were never really, and you know, Voltaire is probably in his late 40s, so he would have been around since early 80s, right?
Maybe at a point where we get grandpa goth. But
yeah. Well, like, the things that he was saying is, you know, he wasn't pulled into the scene, quote unquote, by like The Cure or anyone. It was new wave to him. And even like Rogue at that point, I think, chimed in and mentioned that, you know, he's actually friends with Robert Smith, The Cure. Mm-hmm. And
I'll name drop much?
Well, no. So he dropped that name, not as a, like, I know Robert Smith, but mm-hmm. It was a way of setting up the story of, he's like, you know, we were, you know, a few years ago, his band was being considered opening for The Cure. But Robert Smith told him that they would love to have them play with them on tour, but they're too gothy for them. And he said Robert Smith goes a step further and does not see The Cure as a goth band. They're a new wave band to him.
That's amazing.
Which is insane, right?
Like, still new wave, man. Hold on to that.
Yeah, like, well, and apparently the like the Sisters of Mercy specifically have a statement in their contract whenever they play music festivals. The festivals cannot advertise themselves as being goth festivals or the Sisters of Mercy as a goth band. If they do, they will take their performance fee and not play the show, because that's how strongly they disassociate themselves with the term goth. Is they're like, nope, we're going to get paid for doing nothing because that's not how we see ourselves and you're mislabeling us. Which is really weird.
It is really weird. I mean, there are tons of bands that never really liked being associated with a particular movement.
Yeah. And I mean, if you look at videos of other, of The Cure specifically, like their first few music videos from the 80s, they didn't really have that look.
Mm-hmm.
They just looked like any other band of goofy assholes with guitars and... Mm-hmm. keyboards, like everyone else in the 80s. But it's funny to kind of see rivalries and egos kind of clash on a panel where they would like get digs in at each other, where, you know, like Rogue is kind of being like playing up the aspect of someone who's like kind of above it all. And like, he's more cerebral and more spiritual and like that sort of ego. And then at the other end of the table, I noticed, I don't know if it was just where they happened to be placed, have their name cards placed, or if they specifically moved them, but you have Voltaire showing up and playing the part of the rock star. Like, he showed up to the panel with like two or three drinks in his hand and like was getting progressively more loud and more lugubrious as the panel went on and his drinks disappeared. It was a fun panel. It was interesting. And it's funny because it was so musician heavy, like when they were all talking about their backgrounds as like an introduction, like even like Ted Nafee even said, yeah, I'm not a musician. So, I took some inspiration from Edward Gorey, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that makes me goth.
Yeah.
I have darker themes in my comics, but that's not... He's like, there really was no in for me into any sort of scene. Mm-hmm. So it was just interesting to hear their insights on how the scene has changed and moved and kind of molded and the clothing signifiers have changed, the aesthetic and the music has kind of dispersed and it's more mainstream in some aspects. Because, mm-hmm. you know, like you have festivals like the Mira Luna Festival in Germany. And I want to say that the headliners there, one of the main headliners was like Korn. Korn is not an underground band by any means. Like when you're a platinum selling artist, you're not underground. That's mainstream.
Platinum selling albums, yeah.
Yeah, like so it's interesting that something that used to be like, oh, the nerdy kid that sits in the corner in the lunchroom is now just like rock stars and
yeah, there's definitely a populated fan base for that.
Yeah.
I think it's it probably has less to do with the actual term than partly maybe the baggage that goes along with that term.
Yeah.
And also like a marketing aspect of it. Because if you have if you have like a comic book or like you do like illustration for different things,
yeah,
you don't want to be necessarily listed as like a goth comic book artist, because then you'd have just a regular comic book goer and it's like, I'm not really into goth comics, you know, so they don't even look at your stuff because they're not even, they think you're a particular genre and they think everything that you have is part of that genre.
Well, it's funny, like I want to say that I've seen an interview with another artist named Jonan Vasquez. He did Invader Zim. The thing that kind of got him the job doing Invader Zim was a comic book called Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, which is amazing if you've never read it. It's probably the gothiest comic book I can think of. It's definitely for mature readers. There's a lot of cosmic weirdness and occult stuff in it. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely not what I would expect a guy who had a show on Nickelodeon to put out. So, well, like, I can see what you're saying.
Was subversive. It was.
Oh, it was. Yeah. I wish it had more than three seasons. I love that show.
That show was really, really odd. And it's one of those things that.
More organs means more human.
Yeah. You know, you can kind of sneak that in under there at that period of time where there's, I think now, like, you have to kind of head straight for like Adult Swim.
Oh yeah, that would kind of. Yeah, I don't remember how that was marketed, mm-hmm. because I think I was in college when that came out.
It was just like a show.
Like it was just a kids show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know where it ran in the time slot, because I watched it through other means, but like, because I was in college maybe when it came out. So it's not one that I was around TVs for.
So what's the art style of like Johnny the Homicidal Maniac?
It's very much like Invader Zim. That angular. Mm-hmm.
Is it like, was more time thin. Taken for it? So does it look even prettier, or is it like?
It's black and white.
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, as far as like the art style, because sometimes you get.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I want to say he self-published, so it would have been one of these things like with Jeff Smith doing Bone or Razel, mm-hmm. you know, issues would come out whenever he got done with them. Okay. Because he was writing and drawing mm-hmm. and all of that at the same time. So
yeah, well, Bone was really pretty.
Yeah, yeah. Bone is a beautiful comic. I would love to see a movie of it.
Oh, man.
Animated, like I would want mm-hmm. it to be stretched out over series, not.
That'd have to be like several seasons.
Because, yeah, well, I mean, everything is so streamlined in it that you could probably do it in a season, maybe two. Okay. Yeah, like 15 episodes. Because, like, there's a lot of stuff illustrated in it that wouldn't take up too much screen time, because a lot of it is prose heavy. So. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's neither here nor there. The panel, the Heart of Darkness, the goth panel, was really, really interesting, I think. Mm-hmm. I really recommend that track. It's on the, I think it's on the horror track, because it's in the West End with all the other horror panels.
I just love how there's like no better place to put that other than in the horror track. Because I feel like you guys, I by the time I got to the horror track, my schedule was full. And I was like, there's a lot of cool stuff in here. Like, why is this all stuck in the horror track? So necessarily, I don't really see any reason why that particularly would have to be in the horror track.
I don't know. I guess it depends on, like, the drop-down menu that these panelists are applying for.
Mm-hmm.
Or the fans who coordinate it, like maybe that's the other stuff they're into, and so they're like, I'm going to see if these artists can mm-hmm. come to this panel or whatever, and so it just kind of gets filed away there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know how all of that's set up, but, you know.
It's just interesting.
Yeah, it's weird, honestly, that that's where they decided to stick them, but...
I mean, I'm glad they're there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's panels on, like, Gothic Lolita fashion that are under the Silk Road track, because that's mm-hmm. more of a Japanese thing, so...
Gosh, why didn't I go to that panel? That panel sounds awesome! What?
And there was... I want to say, in years past, there has been a Gothic Lolita, like, fashion show that I've never been to, and it may not be a thing anymore, but I know I've seen it.
Just a very quick aside, what actually we mean by Lolita... For those that aren't familiar with that,
yeah, look up
style
Tokyo street fashion and Gothic Lolita. Like it's a whole look, like wearing infantilized clothes. It has nothing to do necessarily with the book Lolita.
Yeah, no.
It's, you know, very puffy collars and flouncy dresses. And
just think like French made times like a million.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
a
yeah,
million
yeah.
and five. So it's just very a lot of lace.
Very cartoonishly arranged. And, yes. Yeah.
All different kinds of styles, colors. Gothic Lolita just sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Because when you have the restriction of, I would imagine, a smaller color palette,
yeah,
you have to get creative. And you might even include leather. Which would be amazing.
So, yeah, the Gothic Lolita color palette seems to be like hot pinks with grays and blacks and mm-hmm. deep purples and stuff like that. But, yeah, I didn't go to that panel. So
yeah,
I'll hand it back off to you, because I think the next thing I have on my list was the thing that we met up for. So do you remember what you did on Friday after the, George Lowe panel?
Well, it might've been the Flash panel. Might have been that. I'm not sure. Okay. But I think I'm going to go with the Flash panel.
Okay.
The Flash panel, I think it was that first one, because Jennifer Ackerman, I forget her name, she plays a character on the Flash show, and she wasn't able to come for the panel because her flight was really late.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that was like a Friday thing.
Mm.
And I was really looking forward to seeing her there, because one, her character is a lot of fun on the show. She plays Killer Frost.
Oh.
Yeah, so that character. One, because she's very pretty. I'm sure she would have been great to look at for an hour. And two, her character is really fun. And she seems like the kind of personality would do well in a panel. Because she's very witty and kind of has that conversational stuff. So she would have been the heavyweight on that panel. So her removal was actually really interesting, because then you had the other three that were left and just their dynamic.
And so who were the
working.
Other three
the other
that were
three
left?
The other three would have been the guy who plays Eobard Thawne, so Reverse Flash.
Okay.
But not the doctor, like the actual Reverse Flash.
Oh, but the, yeah, yeah. Okay.
The actual Reverse Flash, the one who shows up on Legends of Tomorrow.
Okay.
That one. And Edward Thawne.
Okay.
The cop guy.
Yeah.
Who's like super nice and polite. And then the other one was... Actually, it was four people, so it was going to be a five-person panel. Was the one who plays Flash's mother.
Okay.
And then the one who plays his father and also plays Golden Age Flash.
Okay.
And so then they were kind of there, and golden age Flash guy. He's obviously been in a lot of different things, and he's had a bunch of different parts. And the other ones have, like, different sort of TV careers. I'm not so familiar with the Flash's mother, her particular career track. I'm sure she's done stuff. So it was just really great, because you could see that within that show, they're all... they're all sort of minor characters, and by that I just mean they didn't have a long-standing role on, like, every single episode. Like, they might have had a particular focus for a particular story arc, but none of them were, like, mainstays on the show.
Got it.
But they're all really great. The Golden Age Flash talked a lot about how the original Flash series, which he was in, and he was playing Barry, and he talked about how they got through, I think, maybe a season of that before it was canceled, and how it was really difficult to do the special effects back then. It would have been like The Adventures of Lois and Clark kind of level.
Oh, okay.
But even further back, right. I think, as far as what they were capable of doing. He talked a lot about the suit and outfit that he had to wear, which I think he said was just like latex. It was just like a latex and foam suit. And so he says the suits that they have now are much more comfortable, and they're designed, and they have, seamstresses and just really fantastic tailors and artists
actual
making these
clothing, yes. Not like
not
spandex.
Just like these little rubber suits, which would have been like spandex, and then the latex body cut, because he's got to be like all ripped.
He's got to be ripped and gigantic.
And that's the way they did that back then, was with the latex,
right?
And so he said they made. Gosh, it was. I thought it was a ridiculous number of those suits.
Like 20 of them or something?
It would have been like something. It was either a ridiculous number or a ridiculous cost. Because I think it was something in the area of like 30,000
to
like produce these things. And I think you're probably talking like Hollywood money at that particular point in time, and how it was very specialized, and it would have been something that you would have used for like a movie production, so you needed like a certain level of visual flair to it.
Right.
But how they weren't washable or cleanable.
Oh, no.
So that all he could do was, after you would take it off, like sweating, they would literally just spray it down in Lysol. Like, they would just spray it in Lysol and then just hang it out to dry.
Oh,
till
God.
The Lysol came off.
Oh,
and
no.
So he would still put it on like the next day because they'd be shooting. And it would still be kind of wet with, like, Lysol and, like, sweat mix.
Well, if they used anything with neoprene, I've heard that, like, it absorbs water. So, like, they couldn't, like, run a hose through it or anything. It would have to be something chemical-based.
Yeah. So they just had to Lysol it. And he said, I think he was kind of joking and also not joking. And that closer towards the end of the season, like, people just didn't like being around him because it just smelled. Because it's just a thing that you've just been sweating in for like 10-hour-plus days of shooting. Yeah. And so he was actually a really good storyteller.
Okay.
And he did a great job. Because obviously he's had a really long career. He's got a really strong perspective.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen him play the dad in like tons of different things.
Yeah.
And so then the one who played the mom character, she made a couple jokes about how she would love, you know, to have like a bigger role, you know. And she also was really funny talking about how for like the first two seasons, she basically just had to wear like the same outfit, because the only time she'd come up in a scene was when she was being murdered. And obviously for continuity purposes, she's going to wear that
same outfit.
So she's like, just for that period of time, they would call me up and be like, okay, we have a scene for you to shoot. And then she wouldn't hear about them for a little while. And then like a month before they shoot, they'd send her like, hey, here's the episode. Here's the script. You know, we want you to come back in and whatnot.
And she's like, the scene again.
Yeah.
Damn.
The scene. Like, shooting this again. I got to die again. And she's died tons of times on that show. And I was really, I shouldn't have been surprised, but the actor who played Ebod Thawne was just really articulate. And really smart, and he obviously plays an articulate and smart character in the show.
Right.
And he was really great. I'm trying to think of just particular, like, little niblets of story that they would have talked about. Oh, he did make a mention how it was difficult for him once he got... And also, it was funny. It was difficult, not necessarily difficult for him, but also difficult for other people in the show to kind of wrap their mind initially around the time travel element, especially for the first, like, one or two seasons.
Really?
Because they would get... It's they would get to a point and they would be like, okay, what point in the timeline, especially Ebert Thawne's character, he's talking about, okay, so what point in the timeline am I at? Because like when Ebert Thawne would come back for like after Flashpoint,
yeah,
you have Ebert Thawne there, and Ebert Thawne knows because he's stranded as well with Barry, and Ebert Thawne knows that, hey, this isn't the right timeline. Like, Barry, you've messed with stuff. Like, yeah. Things are bad. And so in order to act out the particular scene correctly, he'd go to, like, the director and stuff. Like, okay, in this point in time, what do I know? Like, what does Ebert Thawne know? Like, what point in the timeline is he originating from?
Wow.
So that I make sure I add authenticity to my acting. Because you'd also have, I think, a particular scene that isn't in there later on where Ebert Thawne is getting talked to afterwards by Barry, because Barry's trying to get his help,
right,
to try to figure something out. And, you know, he's trying to play with the idea of, okay, what does Thawne know right now? And so, okay, Thawne, it isn't going to know this, so I have to make sure that I don't act like that has that particular point of knowledge is in the character.
Well, it makes me want to know if they have just a single story Bible that mm-hmm. the show follows, or if they have ones for specific timelines that the writers follow, or maybe that the continuity person follows when they're going by. They're like, okay, so it's this timeline. I'm going to know everything in this timeline.
Yeah.
And they have another person who knows everything in that timeline so that they can follow have a sense of continuity.
Now, I think it seemed like the way he was describing it is it was just script-based.
Okay.
So they would just give you the script and then...
Oh, so the actors don't have access, because I would be surprised if... There's someone
there, a showrunner who's got to hold that in and be like, okay, we've got to make sure we don't mess that part up.
Yeah, I mean, I would be surprised if a screenwriter doesn't have access to a script Bible, but yeah.
So he would talk about, most of the time I didn't really have questions on my performance, so I just want to make sure, like, is this where my character's coming from, like... Which Ebert Thawne this is. Like, what timeline is he from? And to kind of just make sure to keep it all together. So imagine you get used to acting a particular story arc. You get used to what that character knows.
Sure.
How they act through, and then skipping ahead to something, maybe in like an episode or two, like that Flashpoint one where he was there just for a second.
Yeah.
You'd have to kind of, okay, where am I at now? Hey, where's the show at now? Because they probably weren't involved in production along that whole or period of time that, you know, they're not filming episodes. And the guy who played Eddie Thawne, he was really nice. Again, I'm just going to pick through like little niblets of story. He talked about how when he originally came on the show, he wanted to play Eddie Thawne. Apparently, a lot of his characters in other shows, they're kind of more mean. They're kind of...
Oh, really?
They have... a particular attitude to them.
Okay.
So he tried to play Eddie Thawne that way, and the director was like, no. He's like, look, Eddie Thawne has to be the kind of guy that you can't hate. Like, he is so nice, you cannot find a reason to hate him. Even if you are... even if, you know, he is standing in the way...
Right.
Of like a main character's love interest by his very existence.
Yeah.
You still have to like him. So I need you to play him that way. And that's exactly Eddie Thawne in the show. Like, he's just so likable. And that actually comes across a lot for that actor. He's just very, very charismatic. He has very handsome.
Yeah.
And he's very... You can obviously, like, the rest of the cast is very friendly with him, and, sure. You know, they all like him.
Yeah.
And so, that's pretty much, I'd say, my little points here and there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you do anything else on Friday before your unveiling of your costume?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I might have. The panels kind of like run into each other.
Oh, okay.
So I remember them like individually, but I don't remember
like the order,
sequence of days and stuff. Yeah, definitely. Oh, okay.
All right. Well, do you want to save everything else for Saturday?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, so I guess we'll finish it up with the unveiling of your costume that you worked so very hard on that was creepy as hell.
It was awesome. It was a lot of fun. Basically, I went ahead and did a Silence of the Lambs and Silent Hill mashup, particularly Buffalo Bill. And so my character was named Silent Bill.
Silent Bill, Jesus.
He was fantastic. So basically, I took one of the Buffalo Bill as if he had been cursed in his own particular Silent Hill, which all the Silent Hills... Basically, Silent Hill as an entity just creates its own personal hell for its inhabitants. And so for him, he would have been kind of stuck, you know, forever putting the lotion on his own skin. And kind of the ideas with the bandages and stuff, like his own skin has... And I was going to do more stuff for the arm, but his own skin on his head has been ripped off of his head.
Yeah.
And so then he's just got the lotion, and he's just got to, like, put that on there and forever experience the pain and agony of that.
I really liked the costume because you had, like orderly clothes.
Yeah, it was like a nurse.
That were like
orderly
bloodstained.
Kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. The wrapping around your head and face so that you could like stick your tongue out of the mouth and kind of
delicious.
Wiggle it around. Mm-hmm. Your nails were green for whatever reason.
Yeah,
I think the tea had dyed it when you were.
No, basically, I put green nail polish on the edge perimeter, and basically, I just did the world's worst fingernail paint job.
Okay.
Which is how you get that kind of like rotten look.
Yeah.
Because you make sure to splash it on the side of your, this is makeup
in your cuticle.
Tips.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just get it on, not just on your cuticle, but just all over your nail.
Like the moon shaped part.
Yeah. So just like, just splash it like on, even on the side of the nail.
Oh.
So you splash it.
And it just kind of.
Yeah. You splash it here on your finger too.
Okay.
So I'm trying to say inarticulately all over your finger. And so it's like all along this edge, but right through the middle right here, you don't really do a lot.
Okay.
So it just gets kind of messed up. And then you just kind of rub it to burnish it to give it kind of like an unclear, kind of hazy look.
Yeah.
And so then you get a real intense green perimeter here, and then you get it on the nail, and then kind of just like messy. And so it gives kind of like a hazed green, like gangrenous kind of look.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
A lot of fun.
All right. And how did you put that costume together? Was it like, did you look at tutorials and stuff?
There are like nurse tutorials. And so I basically kind of saw some of the materials and stuff that they would use. The only thing super tip directly was staining would be staining the outfit, which would just be all kinds of teas used to stain it. And then I looked into some other staining stuff. And then the nail bit I saw from a girl who was talking about doing it. I was like, that's a fantastic idea. And
okay.
Other than that, like my head was constructed just using a latex mask, which is what no one else did because it's ungodly hot. And then wrapping that up with even more bandages, which is even more ungodly hot. So just sweating your face off. And the rest of the outfit, I just kind of got an orderly outfit and had fun. You know, rouge, there's the soy sauce.
Yeah.
Was used to stain too. Gave it a lovely scent. The tea, vanilla chai tea latte, also a lovely scent. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You had that little interaction with one of the Silent Hill nurses when we were
so
going
great.
to where the zombie prom was, which is we're meandering towards the zombie prom, but
we're zombie lurching towards the zombie prom. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you like, I guess you got her attention, and you guys like kind of took half-hearted swats at each other.
Yeah, basically we're in character for the nurses because the nurses are in Silent Hill are really funny because not only will they congregate and dance close to one another, but they will attack each other as well.
Oh.
Because they're just these wild little creatures.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's like two mad, ravenous cannibalistic carnivores meeting each other.
Okay.
They could just as well unite and force as much as eat each other. So we're just kind of playing it, which is exactly what two nurses would do.
Yeah.
When they meet up. And so she knew exactly what to do.
Yeah.
She knew what the game was.
Yeah. So she was great. No, it was just a funny interaction with people in costume acting off of one another. I thought that was really fun to watch.
I wish someone got it on video. That would have been great. Because I'm throwing my back out and contorting basically like a rigor mortis nurse, which is part of it. Part of the whole thing, and it's what I'd love to capture that moment on video. I mean, it's in my head. That's cool enough.
Well, and the actual zombie prom, we didn't stay, but maybe, 45 minutes or so? Because I know in the past, they introduced it, I think, right at the cresting of the wave of the zombie fascination. And so there were a lot more people before dressed up like zombies or zombie hunters or what have you. And this year, people just kind of showed up. They showed up dressed in zombie t-shirts or things that had nothing to do with zombies, right? Which kind of a bummer, but whatever. It's people's prerogative.
You could Spider-Man and Captain America, just Spider-Man and Captain America. There was no zombie element to that.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. You could have zombied that up and still be somewhat canon.
With little to no effort.
Yeah.
A little bit of blood. Anything.
Well, and I saw one of the better ironic cosplays, not including yours, that I've seen in a while. And I took photos of it, and I think I'm going to post, I'll probably create a Facebook page for the site or our podcast. Mm-hmm. And I'll post pictures of Dragon Con. But I had to get this guy's picture. He was dressed up as Sailor Mercury, quote unquote. But he was dressed up in a Sailor Scout outfit with a microphone that was bedazzled and shinied up. But the guy looked like Freddie Mercury with the mustache. So he was in a Sailor Scout uniform as Freddie Mercury.
He was beautiful.
He was beautiful.
I loved it. It was so great.
So good.
And he was just running around with just the right amount of stage flair.
Yeah.
Is that Sailor flair? Is that Freddie Mercury flair? I'm not sure. It's great either way.
And he'd do the pose where he throws his arm up and it's wailing into the mic. Yeah, it's beautiful. I forget at what point we left the zombie prom. And on the way back to the hotel, you guys said you had never seen it. So we stopped by the drum circle room because this year they've decided, I guess, to put it on a time frame. And so it's midnight to 4, midnight to 5 or something like that.
Interesting. Why do you got to think, why exactly was it always time framed?
No. So I think that's a consequence of it growing because I know last year that room in the Hyatt was used for, it's always been in that room, that lower level concourse room. Last year was the first year I had been in there and it was a panel room.
Oh, so
it was a larger panel.
They needed that room to just be multipurpose.
Right. Okay. Rather than just, because it used to, my first year back in 04 or 05, I think, the drum circle was just 24 hours. It was just going.
Yeah, Mystic. That's kind of odd.
Yeah, on Sunday or Monday, there was a funk going on in that room because there were some people that they probably didn't stay there all weekend, but pretty funky smelling. Lots of dancing, lots of belly dancing, lots of
Foot sweaty,
yeah, just really, really weird. But it had just started, I think, because someone had, people were still showing up with their drums that they were sharing with people, right? I've never wanted to take my own stuff there because I don't know how they go about getting it back or if people are just going to put it back in the bin that they bring it in. But I don't trust people, especially not as large as it has gotten in some of the element that's come in, but
it just takes one asshole to
ruin everything.
Steal your drum.
But Yeah, it was fun. My wife made me stop, I think, or maybe it was your wife that was just like, "That's really irritating." But
I think it was just like with there was a general conversation there that was for a little bit about how it hadn't really started yet, and so we wanted to maybe come back when it was like in the heat of the drum.
Yeah,
and it was just kind of really it was tepid at that moment.
Yeah, well. Either your wife or mine asked me to stop because I had GarageBand on my phone, and so I was just like adding in little things by like tapping on my phone. I don't have it up now, but it's that's
definitely
just
your wife telling you to stop.
Yeah. hitting random drums. You couldn't really hear anything, mm-hmm. but yeah, I kind of wanted to grab a drum, but then part of me was just like, I don't know the protocol on asking if I can borrow someone's drum, mm-hmm. so. We should just head out.
It's really, especially with something like the drum circle, you kind of get the vibe. I think you get a look back into Dragon Con's like nucleus, like it's
oh
the
yeah that
of its start
that and the filking and all of that stuff like that. That's like probably from in 87 when it first started.
Yeah, you get a feel almost like this. Dragon Con almost sprung out from things people would do, and this is not a literal interpretation, things people would do for like an after school club.
Yeah.
And then if you just added years of time to that and then people getting older and keep on coming to the club, and then you get a budget put into things,
yeah,
and then like planning, but it still has that kind of homegrown,
yeah,
feel out of it. Because I imagine that is a draw.
Yeah.
But it's not, it wouldn't be the main reason you'd come to Dragon.
No.
It wouldn't be something that you would throw on the brochure.
Yeah.
So much to like get, you know, an outsider to come in.
Yeah.
You know, you'd get like somebody from such and such movie or somebody from such and such show.
Right.
Not like come to our sweaty foot drum circle thing. That wouldn't be it. But it's still, it's part of... That's part of the DNA of Con, at least from my perspective, kind
yeah.
of looking in, you can kind of see that kind of seed.
Yeah, like some of the integral things about Con for me are, yeah, the drum circle, the weird random British tracks like that, like Red Dwarf and Doctor Who and those types of things.
There was even some like new shows that I saw on the track that I wasn't familiar with at all.
Which one? Like Torchwood? And
It would have been Torchwood. There was another one that they were talking about for like a season or something. I don't remember the names.
Oh, of them. Okay.
But they would have been like another BBC show.
Oh, or like a Luther or something more science, like a Sherlock or something like that.
Something more like obscure than both of those.
Okay.
I'd never heard
of them. I mean, those aren't obscure. I'm not saying those are obscure. I'm just saying mm-hmm. that those are shows that I know of that would have been on the track.
I mean, that I would have recognized and been like, oh, that's kind of cool. But these other ones, kind of like with The 100, which isn't an obscure show, but the amount of events they had for The 100.
Yeah, there were a lot of things really and a lot weird. Of people there from the 100 that it's just like, I've never seen an episode of the show. I don't even know what it's about. It's about people that are coming back to Earth, right?
I think The 100, from what I was looking into, because I was, what is this, has to do with basically the people that are left after like a rapture-like event. So they're there, left
oh, okay.
in like a post-apocalyptic world, and then they have to kind of...
Okay.
Survive and exist with each other.
So it's kind of like a post-apocalyptic dystopia type.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that and yeah, them trying to survive that
okay.
kind of world. And more than that, I have no idea. I do know there was a lot of events and panels for it, which is astounding.
Yeah, I noticed those too, and I was just like, I don't know what this is, but. So like I wasn't going to wait in line for something that I have no idea what it is. Like mm-hmm. I'd like to have some idea of what I'm going to.
And you think maybe different show fan bases will kind of hit their peak at particular points in time.
Yeah.
And maybe for a show, because I thought I saw something about it being like the last season for them or something, or talking about
this might be probably the
final season coming up.
Okay.
And so it might have been something that possibly last year they had like one or two.
Yeah.
And they were like max capacity and it was just, you know, not manageable. And then the fan base got on the little comment thing is like, we need more days for the 100. And so it's like, oh, we'll give you like 4 days then. You know, whatever you want, we'll give you more space. You know, it's a vocal fan base. And then the con kind of responds to that. It's, I mean, there's so much other thought I could put into this as far as how that works out. It's interesting as a, even just from like a year to year kind of thing.
Yeah.
Watching like a change and trying to think behind the scenes how that might have been orchestrated.
Right. But yeah, oh yeah, back to the drum circle. Sorry, we're getting off on tangents on this. We're sprawling like mm-hmm. through everything because that's what con is like. It sprawls and it goes in different directions and we come back.
We're announcing our new 100 podcast we're gonna be having. That's gonna be tri-weekly. Three times a week.
Three times a week mm-hmm. on a show that has not that many episodes, mm-hmm. I'm assuming.
It's gonna be great.
So then for our like let's wind down, go to bed, whatever type thing that we had on the background because we're four people in a hotel room, so it takes a while for everyone to like get in a I'm going to sleep now.
Yeah, four mode. People, one hotel room, one twin. It's tough.
We had two doubles.
I love how quick he was to correct it.
No, it's not that I'm offended. It's I've been in rooms where there's two double beds, but there's like eight people staying in it. And the hotels, I don't think will let you do that now. Like mm-hmm. past four keys, they've started, I've noticed, especially at con, charging for extra room keys past what they've allotted. Yeah. Right. So you can't have 8 to 10 college students cramming in a two bed room anymore because they're not going to pay $50 a day for another key. So, so that is a thing that some people do at a convention. We luckily had two doubles, a smaller room, but
sweaty foot smell with eight people. I can't even imagine.
Yeah. Oh, it's a thing that you do because you're desperate and you want to go to something. So we put on Wizards of the Lost Kingdom Part 2, mm-hmm. which has nothing to do with the first one other than being, I think, the same producer.
I remember less about that one. Like, I'm just trying to put it. It's that one kid. Yeah, it was. I found it less charming, but it might have been because I wasn't following as much.
Yeah, it was the kid. He looks like the older brother from the Wonder Years, and a fat wizard that doesn't really want to be helping him, but God tells him to, and so he does. Like, I was in and out of that one as well. I don't like it as much as the first one.
Yeah, the first one just has a lot of initial charm, I think.
Then David Carradine's in it because he loves money. He is the dark one, and he owns a tavern where his wife is the dancer, and then he threatens people with his sword to tip her. Like,
really bad jokes. Like, he had really...
Oh, yeah. It was... Yeah.
Like bad lines and just... He just seemed like a really unsavory character.
Yeah, like, there was... Like, he's a good guy, I guess, but his name is the Dark One. Like, that's not what you really name a hero, but okay. It was the one that was most apparently two different movies shoved mm-hmm. together, just with a similar looking actress that was playing ostensibly the same character. It was two women with, I guess, blonde hair. I forget now. Blonde, reddish hair. Mm-hmm. They kind of look alike in that they were both white, I guess. So if you put a chainmail bikini on them and put them on a horse, I guess they look similar enough for the movie's purposes.
Yeah. What would you bet that Carradine couldn't have come up to the director and just had like a role similar to like the first one?
Yeah.
And Carradine was like, no, I got this character. He's called the Dark One. And the director's just like, yeah, whatever, man.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. There is no, as far as I know, Wizards of the Lost Kingdom 3, although I really want there to be. We could write that movie.
We could write that movie.
Guys, give us money. We have no track record. We have no camera. We will make a shitty, shitty Wizards of the Lost Kingdom Part 3.
You could film it in the back area of my apartment complex because we
have... Oh, it's very wooded.
We
have
wooded. And what would be great would be to film like several different scenes that are supposed to be different places in the same area. So we could hang like a sheet and some colored cardboard and that could be the castle area. And the thing about it is before you'd have low production films like Homebrew were obviously indicated to you by this is recorded on a VHS thing. It looks like crap.
Yeah.
Now you can have it look really good and still be crap.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. I love it. And you can edit in. I mean, you can get particle effects that are just the worst. You can get Dragon Ball Z stuff. Wow, we could have like a whole scene in the middle of the movie where we just start Dragon Ball Z-ing for no reason.
This character is not Goku, it's Kugo.
Yeah, it's Kugo. We could both find like artifacts in the mud that transform us into superpowered, what do we get? Superpowered crayons. We're called crayons.
Okay.
And so each of our hairs are different colors. Like crayons.
Well, I've got no hair.
See, that'd be the power thing. It would like the hair would pop out.
Oh, it would
out.
Give me hair so we could get a weird...
It would just pop out as an energy field in the shape of hair.
Yes.
You'd still actually be bald.
Yes.
Yeah. Or you'd get the reverse.
That sounds awesome.
And your beard would be like... Would have the energy thing.
Yes.
So it'd be like, whoosh, or like even at the beginning, like this is entirely too much effort, but it's fun to think about. Even at the beginning, your powers would get activated and your head was trying to decide where it wanted to shoot the field.
It just kind
of it was like off and on. So it'd be like, psh, 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 coming into the beard as well. And so it would like flip kind of like a flickering
just
like a light switch.
Just around my head.
Mm-hmm. And then you could either like tap it or like
put all
tug.
That shit in post. Well, you have Premiere through your Adobe thing, right?
I got
so
the stuff.
You guys give us money. Give us like $1,000 and we'll make the most entertaining feature length movie you guys have ever seen. We'll shoot it all on iPhones.
Yeah.
I have it on pretty stable sources that a guy who makes some amount of money as a director. Some of the like consumer quality cameras out there, the iPhone 7, or well, I have a 6, but the iPhone 7's camera is as good or better when you're talking about video Pixel 8. So it's a thought. We have phones.
We could
give
do
us
it.
Money.
We have means. I could do it with $10 just to pay for my time. It'd be amazing. Anyways.
So that was Friday. Mm-hmm. The look on your face tells me that we should probably cut this off and do a Saturday-Sunday
episode. Yeah, we're probably pretty good. We're like at 2 hours right now.
Okay. All right.
But I have cut it here. And
so, yeah, we'll see you guys next week. We'll talk about the Saturday-Sunday and... Maybe talk a little bit about what we bought there, because one of the experiences of going to Con is always going to the dealer room, as your wife pointed out, because I've been going to places when it was called the dealer room.
Mm-hmm.
It's now in the America's Mart, and it's on several floors rather than just one open space, so it's now technically a vendor hall.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to call it. I call it a dealer room because I'm old and...
There's so much there. I mean, there's also the possibility of doing like a wrap-up, which is probably what we'll do as far as our experiences. Because there's tons of random little thoughts and experiences.
Yeah.
And we'll, I guess we'll try to keep that to an end section. We didn't do a good job of that now.
Yeah.
But that's the nature of an all-encompassing
of these conversational. And you know, it's a conversational podcast. So if you don't like it, write to us at backrowsupershow@gmail.com. Facebook to be set up shortly. yeah, I'll put these pictures online and you guys can see some of the costumes that we saw that were interesting. Maybe even some video clips of things that we may or may not have taken.
Be great.
So see you guys next week. Let us know if there's anything we can do to change the show or make it a little bit better. Yeah, see you later. Bye.
All right, have fun in the back row, guys.
Bye. In the darkest edge of night.